The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
One thing I like about this particular topic, the sensory worlds of other animals, is that it itself, though a singular cohesive topic, is also the gateway to thousands of small wonders.
Ed Yong talks about his new book, An Immense World, which asks us humans to break out of our sensory bubbles and consider the unique ways that dogs, dolphins, mice, and other animals experience their surroundings.
I'm not the judge of these people. I'm not the jury of these people. I'm just the observer. And if they took stuff seriously, I did too.
Terry Alford is here to talk about In the Houses of Their Dead, which examines the role of spiritualism in the families of Abraham Lincoln and his assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Plus, my colleagues Lauren Christensen and Jumana Khatib join me to talk about what we've been reading. This is the Book Review Podcast. It's June 24th. I'm John Williams. Ed Yong is here. He won a Pulitzer Prize last year in explanatory reporting for his series of pieces in The Atlantic about the COVID-19 pandemic, which the Pulitzer Board called lucid and definitive. He is the author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. And his new book also widens the aperture on our view of life. It's called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. Ed, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I want to start by asking what role the pandemic played in maybe pulling you away from this project. Is this a book that normally would have come out a couple of years ago? And how did finishing it in those circumstances pan out?
Yeah, I think it should have come out last year. I actually started writing the book in October of 2019 and was pulled away from that pretty much at the halfway mark. Half the chapters were already written, and then I put all of that away to focus on covering COVID for most of 2020. It was a bit of a jarring experience to go from writing about the sensory worlds of other animals to writing about this global upending catastrophe and then to head back into it. But I think that the latter piece was much needed. This book is about joy and wonder and the almost mundane magnificence of the natural world. And at a time when the natural world seemed to be beating us down relentlessly, it was a much needed balm to return to a place of finding happiness and awe in it.
Yes, reading this book is definitely different than reading about the grim news that we were going through for the past couple of years. You strike me as someone, and correct me if I'm wrong, who's deeply interested in a thousand different things. So I want to know what led you to this subject for a full-length book, and also what you hope the larger point of the book to be, because there are details on every page that we'll get to that are really fascinating, but what did you want those details to add up to for readers?
I am interested in a thousand different things. I've often said that my beat is everything that is or was once alive, which covers billions of species across basically the entirety of the planet's history. And that's quite a lot. One thing I like about this particular topic, the sensory worlds of other animals, is that it itself, though a singular cohesive topic, is also the gateway to thousands of small wonders. There's so much to learn about just in this one corner of biology. And it suits someone like me, who is, I think, very omnivorous in their intellectual tastes. As you say, like there are so many great details in this topic. And, you know, I really wanted every page, maybe even every paragraph, to have some moment that would blow a reader's mind. I've joked that I wanted An Immense World to turn people into the best/worst dinner guests imaginable. You know, the details are fascinating in themselves, but I think I want them to add up to, I guess, an ignition of curiosity and empathy. I think that the ways in which animals perceive the world around them are endlessly fascinating, but something that I think a lot of people don't think about. Once they start thinking about it, I think you can't help but see other creatures and, in fact, the entirety of the world around us in a radically new and different way that I think just sparks us to ask questions. You know, I think of my dog differently. I think about the the sparrows and the starlings in that I can see from my window differently. I hope the book engenders that kind of inquisitiveness in readers. I think that's important if we want to protect the world around us. I hope it helps people to build their empathy muscles, to really engage in a kind of radical act of perspective taking for creatures that are so different than they are.
You mentioned seeing the sparrows differently. I do wonder if it made you see yourself differently, but we're going to get to that later, because first I think we should dive into the animals themselves, because part of your point in this book, and you say it explicitly, is that we're often interested in animals, whether it's in lab tests or in learning how they interact with the world, to find out how we might better interact with the world or help ourselves. And the book's purpose is really not to think that way, but to put ourselves as much as we can into the perspective of the animals for its own sake, and to, like you said, have some kind of empathetic or just intellectually interested response to that. So let's start with, you mentioned your dog. Let's start with dogs, because it's an animal that probably most of our listeners have experience with, hopefully more than, say, bold jumping spiders, which we might get to later. And so I'm going to ask listeners to do something you ask readers to do on the page, which is to take a deep breath. So we'll all just do that for 2 seconds. Now, how is that experience for us different than it is for our dogs?
So when we take that breath, air rushes into our nose. We can smell, we can grab some of the molecules that that air contains. But then when we exhale, we wash all of those odors out of our nose. For a dog, things work differently. Their nose anatomy splits the stream of air into two chunks. The smaller tributary goes back to a region of the nose that is entirely devoted to smell. So in this anatomy, plus other parts of the dog's nose, the shape of its nostrils means that dogs can just continuously sniff and get a constant influx, a conveyor belt of scent into their nose without hyperventilating, as I would if I just repeatedly sniff, or without repeatedly flushing all that juicy stimuli. That's just one way in which dogs inhabit this profoundly olfactory world. Their sense of smell really is primary to them. I watch my dog, Typo, sniffing away, and he'll walk for entire blocks and just continuously sniff. He uses his nose to explore, to go on little sensory adventures. He'll delicately sniff at newly emergent shoots that have sprung up from the ground. He'll sniff bits of sidewalk that other dogs have peed on and get a sense of who those dogs are, what they've been up to recently.
I love how quickly and straight-facedly you said the name of your dog, which is Typo, which is an all-time great dog name.
Thank you. Great for a writer, I think.
You also have a moment in the book where you talk about the way that dogs breathe, and you mention an English pointer, and you say parenthetically, who was curiously named Sir Satan, who created an uninterrupted inward airstream for 40 seconds despite exhaling 30 times during that period. So this is the kind of, just to give readers a sense of the granular detail in the book. You mention at some point the classic 1974 essay by Thomas Nagel, the philosopher, called What Is It Like to Be a Bat, which is a really great piece. You say he was interested in finding out the subjective experience of being a bat, or what that would mean to understand that. And you said you could envision yourself with webbing on your arms or insects in your mouth, but you'd still be creating a mental caricature of you as a bat. And he wants to know what it's like for a bat to be a bat. How much in this book are the scientists you meet with and the labs they're working in? There's no way to get to that subjective experience. So how close are we trying to get, and how do we do that?
I think science can get us close. A bat is a good example. Most bats navigate through echolocation. So they produce high-pitched calls and they listen out for the rebounding echoes. And by the qualities of those echoes, they can sense the distance and other physical properties of objects around them. They can hunt insects, they can navigate their way through dark caves and so on. And incredible sense. But the bats also fine-tune their echolocation calls according to their needs. So they can change like the frequency of those calls or how often they call, depending on what kind of information they want to wrest from the environment. And that means that if you record a bat's calls as it flies, you can almost get a window into its mind. You can almost read its intent, like what it's trying to focus on in the world around it. And that's, I think, incredible. It means that echolocation, despite being this weird, exotic sense, is actually very studyable. And yet, there is always going to be this gulf, as Nagel correctly identified, between a bat's subjective world and mine. I'm going to struggle to try and understand what it is like to perceive the world through rebounding echoes. And that means that this book that in which I'm attempting to draw readers into that sensory world, there's always going to be a slight unfinished bit of business at the end, where we're all going to have to take a bit of an imaginative leap into the unknown, and in the knowledge that we'll never entirely get there. But I think that the argument I make is that the attempt to do so, the journey that we undergo, is well worth taking because it opens our minds up in such profound ways.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the book, and that I've enjoyed in a few select other popular science books over the years, is that you met with so many of these scientists and you get their words and their experiences and their lab work. And so there are these sort of profiles throughout. There's one very funny moment where someone turns to you as they're walking into a lab closet and they say, "You're definitely not allowed to come in here." And you say, you obediently stay outside. How was it spending time in all those labs, and how did you decide where to go and who to talk to?
I think it was really important to me to get some face time with the scientists who do the work that underpins the book, and partly because it's their story too, that scientific discoveries don't just fall out of the sky. They come through hard work, and the process through which we know about the senses of other animals is as much a part of this story as the experiences of those animals themselves. I tried to find researchers who could show me something interesting, you know, who allow me to interact with a manatee or a mantis shrimp or a bat, or worked in places where I could see them interacting with those animals. Because I think in those little moments, when you get to watch people who've deeply thought about these creatures and the way they sense the world, you just get little flickers of magic. I can write about how a ground squirrel doesn't feel the cold in the same way that us humans do. But there's nothing quite like holding a ground squirrel in my hand and feeling just how cold its body is, and yet how sound asleep it also is. I write about the black ghost knifefish, a fish that creates its own electric field, which allows it to sense objects in its environment in all directions. And I can write that and it sounds cool, but then it's extraordinary to just watch these fish actually put that skill to use. Through their electric sense, they can swim backwards, they can flip upside down, they can reverse and then swim up the side of a wall without even looking at where they're going. All of that in-person experience, I think, enriches what would otherwise be quite a didactic read.
Well, let's keep making people better dinner guests. You just started with another anecdote. Let's talk about the beetles who mate in forest fires.
Right. So there are several species of fire-chasing beetles that can sense the infrared radiation given off by fires. They can sense that over very long distances, and they use that to fly toward forest fires, which seems like a bizarre thing to do. But they do that because a charred forest is actually an incredibly good place for a beetle to lay its eggs. The trees are weakened, so their own defenses have been tamped down. There are a few predators around. So these beetles, through their extraordinary senses, head toward burning forests, and then, in probably the most dramatic sex in the animal kingdom, mate amid the flames and then lay their eggs in the charred bark. It's very metal, I think.
And then when the newly birthed beetles come out, they get to feast on these charred trees without any predators, right? Because everyone else is avoiding the forest because of the heat and the ashes and the embers.
Right. There are no predators around. The tree's own defenses have been weakened. You know, it's a great place if you're a young beetle.
If you're a young heavy metal beetle. So we humans are very visual creatures, as you emphasize a few times in the book. What about our senses is maybe the weakest relative to the rest of the animal kingdom? What are we missing out on most?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, there are some senses that we lack altogether. So I cannot sense the magnetic field of the earth. And yet songbirds and sea turtles can. They essentially have compasses inside their heads that allow them to navigate over long distances. I can't sense electric fields in the same way that electric fish can, or that sharks can. A shark or a duck-billed platypus can sense the minute electric fields that all living things produce, and that's how they can track prey, that they can't see or detect in other ways. You know, even with senses that I think are more familiar to us, like vision, we're limited in interesting ways. So I cannot see ultraviolet colors. And actually, most sighted animals can do that. If I could see ultraviolet, a lot of the world would look very different to me. A lot of flowers would have bright patterns and bullseyes and arrows on them that draw the attention of pollinating insects. You know, some birds where the males and females look exactly the same would actually look very different and distinguishable. The color white would look very different to me. You know, white to an animal that can see ultraviolet isn't the same as white to my eyes. I could go on and do at some length over the course of these 360 pages. The thing about the senses is that the senses create a powerful illusion of completeness. The information they provide to us feels total. And so it's really jarring, I think, to learn that it is in fact not total, that all we're perceiving is just a thin sliver of all there is to perceive.
Has it made you more self-conscious about your own limits? Not in a negative way, but just in the sense that are you walking around more conscious of what you're missing, or are you smelling more deeply and taking more time to smell the roses, as it were?
Yeah, I am. You know, humans actually have a reasonable sense of smell. We're just not very practiced at it. We don't use it to the same extent as, say, a dog. And interestingly, we don't really have a good vocabulary for it, or at least like Western societies don't. There are some hunter-gatherer groups that are exceptions, but it's a challenge in writing a book like this because the lexicon for smells or for some of these exotic senses like electroreception is much narrower than for vision or for sound. I do think more deeply about my own sensory limitations, and I think that I understand those limits better when I can watch what other animals are doing. So Typo, for example, when we go on walks, will clearly spot olfactorily interesting stuff on the ground that I would never have known was there. He'll sniff intently at things that are imperceptible to my senses. He'll sometimes like freak out at something that's going on outside the window that I don't understand. And I don't know whether it's that he's heard something I don't hear, whether he's smelling something I don't smell, whether his eyes, which are less sharp than mine, have caught some visual illusion in the reflections in the window. Those little moments, I think, remind me of how personal and how constrained my own experience of the world is, in a way that I think is actually kind of cool. In some ways, like learning about this stuff can feel limiting, but I think it's actually quite expansive. It shows like how much there is to learn in even settings that feel quite familiar to us.
Well, I think listeners will be glad that we got back to Typo and that we essentially spared them the bull jumping spider, but they can learn about that spider and many other creatures in your new book, which again is called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. And our reviewer says that it showcases Ed Yong's exceptional gifts as a storyteller. Ed, thanks again for being here to talk about it.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Terry Alford joins us now. He is the author of, among other books, Fortune's Fool, The Life of John Wilkes Booth. And he's here to talk about his new book, which also involves the same man, In the Houses of Their Dead, The Lincolns, the Booths, and the Spirits. Terry, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So your book introduces the idea of the Lincolns and the Booths as connected, not just in some other somewhat eerie ways that we've known about, but by the idea of spiritualism. And so I'm just going to start by asking what we mean by spiritualism and what was the state of it in America during the time that you're writing about.
Well, it kind of popped up big time in the 1840s when two young women in Hinesville, New York, claimed to be contacted by the spirit of a dead man buried in the cellar of their house. And pretty soon they were passing on messages from the sky, and the next thing you know, they were touring and became a sensation. They were the Fox Sisters. And the movement spread very quickly. It was a huge phenomenon in the 1850s and 1860s, the Civil War period. This idea that the dead were not gone forever, but were right there, and all you had to do was listen and they would talk to you.
Let's start not with Abraham Lincoln or John Wilkes Booth and his family, but with Mary Todd Lincoln, who lost one child, Eddie, and then lost another son, Willie, in 1862. How much did those losses propel her interest in spiritualism? Had it existed before then?
It was the fuel. There's no doubt about it. The thing about Mary was she really, really enjoyed life and lived in the world of the living. And when anything unexpected like a death in the family happened, it stopped her short. And she floundered and she struggled. And the idea that, you know, that her dead sons were there and anxious to talk to her. They were just now the discarnate standing behind a veil that could be lifted was huge to her. And she really got totally into it.
And she allowed people to try to, I guess, in what we would consider a seance or something like that, to try to draw back the spirits of her sons?
Absolutely. She was visited by and became friends with a number of spiritualists. We don't know very much about before they went to the White House. There's some stories of that. But in 1862, starting when, as you mentioned, her beloved son Willie died, she began to go to seances or bring the mediums to the White House themselves. Willie was a really significant blow for her because she always thought of all of her children, that was the one that would be there for her when she was old. That was the one who would take care of her in her old age. So, you know, this was a staggering loss for her. And, you know, she reached out to the spirit world.
And where does Abe stand in relation to all of this? You write that he was raised in a Baptist family, but that he didn't really have much connection to the kind of Orthodox Christian beliefs. But how did he feel about spiritualism and also about Mary's turning to it in these times?
He was born short in the faith department. You know, miracles and things like that, he just considered physically impossible. And when the time came along for the seances in the White House, he went, I think, A, to keep an eye on Mary, B, to see what this phenomena was that everyone from Queen Victoria to your local butcher were indulging in. And three, and I think we often forget this, these were kind of social occasions. We're too much influenced by the movies. We've seen old movies from the 1930s and 40s, you know, with darkened rooms and candles and skulls. The seances that I could discover at the White House were held in the middle of the day in a sunlit room or at night in a room lit with candles and fireplaces. They would start off with recitations of poetry, singing songs or playing the piano. It wasn't anything eerie in that sense. It was almost like a social thing in which the medium would finally start lapsing into her spirit conversation. So, you know, I think he just found these things entertaining, to tell you the truth. And again, he wanted to see what Mary was up to. What was the whole deal with this?
He was a very rational person, or presented himself that way. He was also, as we know, a fairly depressed person who, as you put it, you know, kept grief close and expected that throughout the course of life, bad things would happen. So maybe wasn't quite as rocked by them as the more positive-minded Mary. But was his curiosity in spiritualism, did it mostly take the form of a kind of giving it's a hearing, or did he ever, do you think, get any deeper sense of consolation from it or ever feel tempted to cast aside some of his more rational beliefs to take it more seriously?
Well, there is a struggle. There's a struggle, as best I see it, in him between the rational side and the side that desires to be comforted and to be in contact with someone you love who's not there anymore. He really wanted that, and he said he wanted that to a number of people, but he just felt at the end of the day that seance-type contact with the dead were really a delusional. It was a struggle in him, that war between his rational side and his faith side, and I don't think spiritualists ever won him over.
He was a very superstitious person in more secular ways, right? He had a lot of...
Yeah. In fact, that's an interesting point. The relationship between superstition and spiritualism. As I write in the book, it would be very odd if Lincoln wasn't superstitious. He was raised in frontier communities, you know, where people planted certain things only when the moon was full. They would travel on Friday, you know, they look for water with witching sticks. I mean, this is just the life on the frontier. And he was remarkably superstitious in some ways. But spiritualists who came along by the time he was an adult said that's got nothing to do with them. You know, that's foolish, superstition. They presented themselves as rational people who were trying to pierce the veil between the living and the dead. And how they say could anything be delusional if it produced physical effects in our world, if it produced noises and movements and voices of dead people? What is that? That's not superstitious. You're seeing it, you're hearing it, you're watching it. So they always defended a line there between spiritualism and superstition.
The patriarch of the other family in the book, the Booths, Junius Brutus Booth, an actor, quite a famous actor at his time, you paint him as a person who was very naturally maybe drawn to ideas like this. Tell us about the scene with the pigeons.
This happened in the 1830s when he called a minister to come to his hotel and help him with funeral arrangements for a friend who was dead. And the minister, of course, obligingly came, but he saw it was a bushel, as they describe it, of dead pigeons in the room with Booth. And Booth wanted to have a funeral for them. And the minister said, you know, we don't do that. You know, they don't have souls. And the elder Booth, how do you know they don't have souls? You know, are they not harmless creatures? Are they not kind and affectionate to their young? Do they not brighten and enhance our world? They have souls just like we do. And you know, the minister said, I couldn't give him a funeral for these creatures, but I did appreciate the amazing sympathy for all living creatures that ran through his request to me. That's an interesting aspect of the family.
And it was passed down to some degree to the sons. What was John Wilkes Booth's natural temperament toward these kinds of things and ideas?
Well, he is interestingly complex. I think it's pretty well documented that he had an absolute fear and loathing of cats and was cruel to them when he was in his young teens. And of course, that is a very disturbing sign that deliberate, intentional, repeated cruelty to animals can be a portent of something else bad later on. But he's complex in this sense. You know, he was extremely protective of horses. Once he saw a teamster beating a horse in the street, he jumped up and punched the guy. He leapt into a river to rescue a dog that a heartless owner had thrown in. He wouldn't let his sister collect bugs for her insect collection. So Booth is kind of complex. Obviously, he hated, I think he feared for some reason, cats. And of course, they have that historic association, right, with evil that's gotten him into trouble over the centuries. But at the same time, you know, he was fond of other animals.
Would he go to spiritualists? Did he believe in this piercing of the veil?
Yes, he did. When his brother Edwin, his older brother, Edwin lost his wife in 1863. She was a very young woman. She just had a child. She was pregnant with another. Edwin was devastated, and John and Edwin would go to seances in New York City and try to reach the spirit of Edwin's wife, Mary. And Edwin said he did have some success. He got messages from her. He even got written communications from her through a medium. So yes, John was interested in spiritualism and had some associations with particularly one very controversial guy at the time of the Lincoln murder.
What was his name? This is a fascinating bridge between the families, among others.
Yes, this is Charles Colchester. real name Jackson Sealby. He was an Englishman from the Lake Country in the UK. And he came to the United States right about the time the Civil War began, 1861, and became very, very popular as a medium. He was extremely talented in doing two things, three really. He could produce noises in different parts of the room. He could read, allegedly, seal messages that you would write to say, you're dearly departed, and he would give you an answer without opening them, apparently. And then he could produce on his arm in blood-red letters the name of the dead person. And that, of course, just freaked people out. He was amazingly successful medium, and he went and comforted Mary Lincoln in the last months of the war and held several interviews with her husband. At the same time, I should add, he was a close friend of John Wilkes Booth, who got him a gig at Ford's Theater.
And Colchester, it seems, may have had reason to believe that Booth posed a danger to Lincoln.
I think anybody who was intimate with Booth in the last weeks of the Civil War, when the net was tightening around Lincoln and his days were starting to be numbered, they couldn't miss Booth's intense anger toward Lincoln. And it's interesting to point out, it wasn't so much against the North. It wasn't so much against any particular general or any particular thing. It was really focused on Lincoln as an individual. It was almost like Booth thought that Lincoln had fired every shot in every battle and was personally responsible for the war and everything bad that had happened in it. You couldn't miss his hostility if you got to know him.
You write that Colchester even gave vague warnings to Lincoln about something potentially bad happening. Did he ever get more specific? And if not, why not, in terms of warning him against Booth in particular?
He did warn Lincoln to take care of himself. And the reason I think Colchester was, as I describe him, a man of misdemeanor, but not felony. In other words, you know, he would pull the dime out of your pocket if you weren't watching. But on the other hand, this murder talk was way over his head. You know, he wasn't even an American citizen. You know, he was just a British guy living in this country, making a living. He wasn't that involved in the issues of the war. I don't think he cared which side won. And all that talk of murder, I think, or harm to Lincoln, frightened him. So he salved his conscience by telling Lincoln to take care of himself and be careful. But he never, you know, he was too good a friend to Booth to really say, you know, here's the person you need to watch. So as far as we know, he was never very specific.
I think that Lincoln and World War II are probably the two subjects that have the vastest libraries written about them, at least in this country. What was it in writing this book that you feel like you learned about Lincoln that made you see him maybe differently than you had before?
The thing about all my work, and I've done a lot of work on John Wilkes Booth, and it's actually increased my respect for Lincoln. The whole thing, it's funny, isn't it, that I would spend decades researching his assassin and then come up with an appreciation for Lincoln. One thing I learned was the tremendous challenges he faced as president and how he was, you know, riding 50 horses at the same time and dealing with monumental egos and military reversals and taking the country in directions like everything from emancipation to the income tax that were new, untried, controversial, even considered revolutionary by some people. So that was certainly one thing I learned. I also was very impressed with the whole interest in the spiritualist phenomena. You know, the death of a loved one is tough to take, and I'm not the judge of these people. I'm not the jury of these people. I'm just the observer. And if they took stuff seriously, I did too, because it impacted the way that they saw things, the way that they acted and treated each other. So I just wanted to know what they thought about all this. And, you know, it was really eye-opening to see the involvement of all these people in spiritualism, and even things like how it related to their religious views. Was spiritualism Christian, for example? Could an honest Christian person be a spiritualist? Many people said no. So it was kind of fun to get into all that and look at those questions through the lives of these individuals.
Yeah, very notable individuals, and it does take us back very vividly to this time in their lives and also in the life of the country and in the life of the country's spirit. The book, again, is In the Houses of Their Dead, The Lincolns, the Booths, and the Spirits. Terry, thanks so much for being here to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My colleagues Lauren Christensen and Jumana Khatib join me now to talk about what we've all been reading. Hello.
Hey, John.
Hey, John. Hey, Lauren.
Jumana, let's start with you this time.
So last time I was on here, I talked about The Last Samurai, and I am continuing with my theme of going back to older books. It's been a while since I've read something new in off hours, so I'm going very old this time. I'm reading The Secret History for the first time by Donna Tartt. I'm in the middle of reshuffling my books, and this came into my hands right before I was going to the beach, and I thought, let's give this a whirl. And across all disciplines, I like spoilers. I don't have any moral objection to them. I kind of think that they enrich my reading experience. They don't perturb me that much. And you could say that reading a book now that has been as thoroughly dissected and riffed upon and borrowed from as The Secret History is the ultimate experience of reading with spoilers. It was Donna Tartt's breakout. And it's about a clique of very exclusive, very eccentric students of Greek at a fictional liberal arts college in New England that was modeled on Bennington, which is where Donna went. These are real character tropes. There's this super charismatic professor who, charismatic, I'm using that loosely. He says, you know, if you want to study with me, I will become your sole tutor. I do all your classes. And so there's a group of five of them. By the time our narrator gets there, there are twins. There's a student in a black cloak who's mysterious and a scholar of all sorts of ancient languages. And then we have our narrator who has fabricated a totally new identity for himself to join this clique and is slowly brought into a very dark underbelly. And of course, there's a lot of elements of what you see in a classic Greek tragedy and all this stuff. But yeah, it's making for great reading, even though you totally know how it ends. She tells you on the first page that somebody's been killed.
This sounds a bit like the Dead Poets Society meets Da Vinci Code.
Yeah. And this is the appropriate level of blood pressure rising that I can accept. I can't handle any... I mean, I already have a steady drumbeat of nerves, so I don't tend to love thrillers or things that make me nervous. Reading should be a break.
I remember loving that book so much, and it came out like, I feel like Donna Tartt, she's written three books and they've all been 10 years apart. I feel like we're due for a fourth one. I think this was her first. And then the second book was A Little Friend, I think is what it was called. And I haven't read it, but it was received as a disappointment. And then she came out with The Goldfinch in 2012 or 2013 or something like that. And it's like this 10, I feel like we're due for a fourth, but I loved that book.
You're totally right about that. It was The Secret History in 92, The Little Friend in 2002, and The Goldfinch in 2013.
Yeah.
What's insanely terrifying about that is that it's been almost 10 years since The Goldfinch.
I know. Well, Lauren, what did you love about Secret History? I'm only maybe 100 pages into it, so tell me what I can expect.
I think I'm just a sucker for the campus novel, and I read this definitely before I read Perfect Nanny, but I always use Perfect Nanny as this like example, just this pillar of the structuring of starting with this big tragedy and this big suspenseful, horrific event. So as you said, like that spoiler that begins the novel and gets your blood rushing. And then it builds this quieter, slower story underneath, but you're anticipating, okay, how do we get to this horrible danger? The campus novel, I mean, I just, the interestings, anything that takes place on a campus with like smart kids being weird, I'm really into.
are you reading something like that right now, Lauren?
I am not. I am reading something very different from that. Well, reading. I listened to the audiobook version. I feel like you guys probably have both heard me talk about this in private, but for our listeners, I've listened to the audiobook version of Melissa Bond's memoir, Blood Orange Night, which is an unusual drug addiction memoir, at least compared to those that I've read in the genre. So it was around 2008, Bond had just found out that her newborn son has Down syndrome, and she's pregnant with her second baby already. She's also just been laid off from her job at the Wasatch Journal. They live in Salt Lake City, around Salt Lake City. So all of this conspires in her life at the same time, and she stops sleeping, which is not totally surprising. She has a lot going on. It's a lot of anxiety, but it keeps going. The insomnia does not stop when she gives birth, which she's hoping it will. And she sleeps at most 2 hours a night, she thinks, sometimes none. She can't really be sure because she's just so sleep deprived and out of it. And those sections literally, sorry, but they kept me up at night. I mean, I was so moved and paranoid just by her really visceral description of the terror of being up all night and your body fighting you. And so she tries everything, but of course she's pregnant and then nursing. So her options are pretty limited. So eventually she finds this doctor whom in the book she nicknames Dr. Amazing. So you know what's about to come. And he prescribes her Ativan, which is a drug that I have heard of. I feel like it's a relatively common prescription name. For context, she eventually works up to this dose of 6 milligrams a day, which doesn't sound like a ton unless you know, which she does, that people suffering from grand mal seizures are given 2 milligrams to... Yeah. So it's a benzodiazepine. She describes it as a sledgehammer. So it really, it knocks her out. She goes to sleep. The problem is that it's a drug that's just what you need in a crisis, but it's very harmful and also ineffective in the long term. People are supposed to take it for like weeks or maybe months, but she's on it for years and she's at this really lethal dosage. So long story short, this drug has been altering her brain chemistry irreparably while also producing no high. And it's just producing this tolerance and then eventual withdrawal, even when she's still taking it. Meanwhile, she's not a psychopharmacologist. You know, she's a mom trying to take care of 2 kids under 3, and she can't eat. She can barely move her body without collapsing. As you can imagine, there's falls that threaten her kids' lives. And so the process of getting herself off this drug takes years. And she studies it, obviously, from a personal perspective and because doctors don't really know what's going on. And she comes to find that it's a potentially more addictive drug than an opioid. And it's much less studied. We hear benzos talked about in our culture, like Xanax and Valium are also in that class of drugs. And she just builds a really convincing case that this is an incredibly dangerous class of drugs that we're not really paying attention to in the way that we are opioids. Anyway, so she narrates this book herself and her voice is just totally brimming with this desperation. I felt like I was her best friend and she was confiding in me when no one else would listen to her. And I just couldn't stop listening to it until the end. And it's so chilling. And I just want to go tell everyone I know to stop joking about like benzos and stuff. But anyway, yeah.
It's good to hear that somebody's able to conjure up insomnia because it's such an isolating thing and it's so particular. And insomnia in its own way is its own form of altered consciousness, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
totally.
Because you're not thinking clearly, you're not really yourself, your thoughts aren't even your own.
It's used as torture.
Totally. And that sounds like something where maybe the experience of hearing it read aloud is maybe even richer than just reading the book.
I think so. I mean, I didn't read the book. She's also a poet, and you can tell that in her delivery. And it feels like some descriptions are so lyrical that it's like, you know, going to a poet's reading. It's really, really moving in audio. John, what are you reading?
Well, I've been getting pretty good sleep lately, so I'm definitely not going to read that, at least not right now. Maybe one day in the future when I can relate again and need sympathetic company. Although it does sound terrific. I'm going even further back, considerably further back than Jumana with The Secret History, which was published yesterday compared to what... No. I've been reading a lot for work, and so a lot of new stuff that I either am going to talk about on the podcast coming up with guests or write about for the paper. And so I haven't had a lot to talk about on here. And I also have been dying to kind of go back into my deep stacks and just pull something really random out, which is what I did. I'm reading a novel by a writer named Wilfred Sheed, who's one of my favorites. It's called The Hack, and it's from 1963. Sheed was a very prolific critic, as well as someone who wrote about a dozen novels, I think, a couple of memoirs, more than that. He came from, his parents were Roman Catholic publishers in the UK. He was born in London, but he lived much of his life in the States. I'm reminded of the time flying about the Goldfinch because he died, it feels like not terribly long ago to me, but he died now 11 years ago in 2011. And he was a critic at the Times for a while. He has collections of his short essays and reviews, which are just brilliant. I think that he's vastly underrated. I've gone on and on about him in other forums, but this book is about a guy who is, in It's funny. He feels deeply in middle age, but of course, back then there's a little bit of a. I'm wondering if he's even 40. But but he wants to reconnect to these two old buddies of his from either high school or college. I forget. And they used to tease each other. One of them was very devout and religious, and the other was this very irreverent person who liked getting the other's goat and like getting him to fight and argue with him about it. And so he goes from his suburban home back into the city to meet up with these guys, and one of them has a family, one of them is kind of a slobby guy who's just dating around a lot still, and both of them are also in the midlife blahs, and they just don't care about that stuff anymore. And he's trying to get them to fight to like get some energy back and like to remember these people in his life, and they just won't rise to the bait. So that's kind of the point I'm at. There are echoes of like John Cheever or Exley's A Fan's Notes, which was written a few years later. It's not quite as sharp as either of those, or as, I mean, in Exley's case, there's almost something, I don't want to say experimental, but that's an intense read. Whereas Sheed is one of these mid-century writers who you're just in good hands. He tells a good story. He's funny. He's affable. He's aphoristic sometimes. And having been raised Catholic, and as many Catholics are, he becomes very pointed and funny about it later. So I just want to read these two short paragraphs to give a sense of his voice. This is a woman's looking into a church and seeing a character named Father Terwilliger, who's finishing up giving communion or something. And Sheed writes, "She peeped past him. It looked dark except for a finger of radiance at the end, a gaudy cross-section of altar. It wasn't Father Terwilliger's fault that he was so sinister. It was this chamber of horrors where he spent his days. The waxworks dressed in satin, the red lamp that never went out, the confessionals that must be full of dead whispers. Terwilliger looked like a tiny curator, slippering up the aisle of a mausoleum. The problem was not so much believing, the world was going to have a far-fetched explanation anyway, but believing that this was good." So he's very witty, and he can be dark. And his novels, I would recommend, they're almost all out of print. I've kind of gathered them through the years because they're available in used bookstores all over the tri-state area. You know, he's one of those writers who had his moment back then, and he's fallen out of fashion. So you can find his they're not in print, but you can find them pretty easily at used stores. And while I'm talking about him, I should just say that there's a book called Essays in Disguise, which is a collection of his pieces for the New York Review of Books and other places about that are more review-like and essay-like. And that the novels are kind of a personal, I wouldn't push too many of them on people, but Essays in Disguise, I think, is a book that everyone should own.
So is he the hack?
Is he the hack? The main character.
We love spoilers, John. We love
Yes. Well, luckily, I'm only about a third of the way through, so I can't spoil too much. But the hack, the character at the center of the book is he writes columns for essentially a religious magazine and newspapers. So he's even sort of sick of himself and these, what he, I think, considers probably bromides that he writes, these soft lens pieces about spirituality. And, you know, so he's dealing with all of that as well. And a kind of feeling like his faith is very lukewarm and chewed over. So let's go over what we've been reading again.
I'm reading The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
I'm listening to Blood Orange Night, My Journey to the Edge of Madness by Melissa Bond.
And I'm reading The Hack by Wilfred Sheed. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm John Williams.
What do 8 bags of concrete mix, a cooler full of 30-pound sea bass, and a 10-inch compound miter saw have in common? They're all things that are easier to load in and out of the bed of the new F-150. Thanks to its new available Pro-Access tailgate that's also a swing gate, the new 2024 Ford F-150, tough this smart, can only be called F-150.
Available starting early 2024, Pro-Access tailgate available starting spring 2024, cargo and load capacity limited by weight and weight distribution.